available. It might not seem that way. It might, like, it might take a year or two, right?
Yeah.
And to know that this is sort of more of a marathon than a sprint. I say that even with non-monogamy in general, like the transition, like this isn't a sprint. You're not going to get to this transition in 3 months. Like, you got to give it a year or two.
Hello, and welcome back to Psych in the City. We have a guest today who I've been super looking forward to having on, Jessica Fern, psychotherapist and author of the book Polysecure, Attachment, Trauma, and Non-Monogamy. We are going to be talking about, dun-dun-dun-dun, attachment theory and trauma. Polysecure, Jessica's book, is one of my more recent reads about attachment, and I continue to refer to it again and again in my work and in my life. It's super clearly written, it's concise, and it's just a solid read and is applicable regardless of your relationship structure. As I was editing this episode, there are parts where I sound not that clear, less than enthused, and this is because I had COVID at the time of this recording, unbeknownst to me. I actually had rescheduled with Jessica one time prior because I thought I had COVID, and then I got sick and didn't want to move it again, so thanks, Jess, for your patience. Hashtag bless Jess. Before we get started, some fun facts about Jessica Fern. Jessica Fern is a psychotherapist, certified clinical trauma professional, and author of the book Polysecure, Attachment, Trauma, and Non-Monogamy. In her international private practice, Jessica works with individuals, couples, and people in multiple partner relationships who no longer want to be limited by their reactive patterns, cultural conditioning, insecure attachment styles, and past traumas, helping them to embody new possibilities in life and love. Learn more at jessicafern.com. Hello, Jessica. I'm very excited to have you.
Yes, thank you. Hi, Sarah. Great to be here.
So you are the author of Polysecure. You're a therapist and a coach. I just want to hear from you, you know, like who you are kind of and the work that you do. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, definitely. So the, you know, main focus of my work, the past 7+ years has been really on, you know, as a therapist, psychotherapist, working mostly with couples, a lot with individuals, doing trauma work, attachment work, and then specializing in people who are in non-traditional relationship formations. So non-monogamy, polyamory, infidelity, figuring out how to integrate a partner, all of that kind of stuff.
I got this from your website, and I just want to talk a little bit, you know, I'm a therapist as well, and I'm always interested in talking about the therapeutic modalities that people have chosen or people that have found really useful in their work. And on your website, I read that you used emotionally focused therapy, narrative therapy, and trigger work. Can you just tell us a little bit like about what each of those are, some of like the principles of each of those modalities?
Absolutely. Yeah. So the trigger work, that was probably like 19, 20 years ago. I started to do more somatic experiencing, you know, Peter Levine's work I was studying.
Yeah.
And in some of the body-based psychotherapy work I was doing, you know, my teacher called it trigger work, but it's all in that genre.
Oh.
I'm really using the sensations and the body to process, you know, triggers, traumas, discomforts, all of it, right? And also like up-leveling and expansion, right? That when we're wanting something different in our life, using the messages of the body and going into the body to see where are things stuck, where do I need to expand, you know, whether that's just through imagination or through the actual body. So that was sort of my first, you know, the first modalities that I did. And then narrative therapy was very central to my work for a long time, which is looking at not just, well, I don't want to say not just as if it's minimizing it, but definitely looking at our stories and the significance of our stories and shaping our realities. But not just that, you know, also looking at how our individual stories are usually related to larger discourses that can be issues that are internalized from our culture around gender, around sexuality, around meaning, you know, how am I a meaningful, worthy person? Oh, I have to have this much income, you know, those kind of stories, and how often that shows up in the therapy room as individual problems, but they're actual societal issues. Yeah. And then And then I started to move more into attachment work. So obviously, you know, Sue Johnson's emotionally focused therapy was the main way to go initially. As we talk about non-monogamy, you know, it's has its limits in that regard of how non-monogamy is spoken about from that model. But that's really looking at the couple and partners and the importance of creating secure attachment and safety and security in the relationship as the path to healing together, as the understanding of a lot of the conflicts and sort of continuous challenges that are happening. Yeah, but I need to update my website because
as we all do.
Right, exactly. It's been a minute. Because really, internal family systems, you know, inner parts work, that is probably like one of my main loves. Yeah. It's just one of my main go-tos, especially around things like working with our insecure attachment as parts that are hurt or parts that are protecting. You know, or using like, oh, when you're triggered, what part is getting triggered? It's not all of you, right? And then the last, it's been about the last year or two, I've been studying with Terry Real and his trainings on relational life therapy.
Interesting.
And that's, if you don't know about that, it's a phenomenal system of sort of doing partner work. And he said he has like a very East Coast, no BS approach that is really refreshing. Yeah. So
cool. Yeah. I just like hearing about the modalities that people have found useful in, especially in approaching like couples work and some of the deep, you know, like attachment wounds. And it's all, it's, I love learning kind of more about what people like and why.
Yeah, exactly.
I actually want to set up this conversation very similarly to how your book was formatted and kind of do it in parts. Right. Initially, you know, in your book, you start with the basics of attachment theory and then attachment theory and trauma, and then you move into the interaction of non-monogamy and attachment. And I guess my first question is, as weird as it sounds, like, why should people care about attachment style? In preparing for this interview, you know, I asked a few of my friends who are not, I don't know, are not into this sort of stuff. And I was like, do you care about attachment style? And they were like, not really. Like, I don't even really know, you know, what it is. And is that something that comes up in your work, either with couples or individuals, or as like, I don't really think this is that important. Like, I don't know why we need to focus on this.
Great question. And no, thankfully, no, I don't get that sort of why do I need to care about attachment? Because I think people who are coming to me at this point, you know, they're seeking help. And most of them at this point now know of attachment because they're coming to me that I do, right?
Yeah, they know that's your bread and butter.
Right. But even clients before my book was written, you know, if they didn't know about attachment and maybe I do a little psychoeducation in a session about it when it was appropriate and felt like it fit, it fit. Right. Yeah. So people were appreciative to usually learn about it. Right. And even just the concept of one partner, like the broad strokes of attachment is like one of you is leaning back and one of you is leaning too much in. Right? And then just that, they're like, yeah, that's exactly what we're struggling with, you know? So no, I don't get people sort of resisting that it's important, but a lot of people obviously don't know that it is extremely relevant just because it's our early attachment experiences, whether they were secure or insecure, really are that blueprint for what we then go on to create in our adult romantic relationships. But it also can show up in our work life. It can show up in our relationship to life itself. You know, it can show up with friends. It can continue to show up in our adult relationships with our parents or our siblings, you know, and then it can continue with, if we have children, our attachment relationships will show up there. So yeah, it's something that left unexplored can go on to create a lot of challenges.
Yeah. So let's get into the bones.
Yes.
What is attachment theory? How can it relate to our relationships? Which you just talked about, but basically, what is attachment theory?
So attachment theory was started by John Bowlby, and then Mary Ainsworth was sort of the researcher who like operationalized it in the lab, you know, made it more real life, in lab and real life scenarios. And so the theory is that, you know, as infants, we cannot meet our own needs. We have to bond with a caretaker who is going to take care of us. But interestingly, our first survival strategy then is actually emotionally bonding, right? And that this attachment sort of system that's wired into us, we're looking for, you know, is there someone here who is protecting me, who cares for me, who is emotionally attuned to me, who is emotionally available to me, right? When I cry, is someone responding? Right. So it's not just, you know, am I dry and fed and warm, the physical needs. It's actually that these emotional needs are the foundation for healthy psychological development and social development. Mm-hmm. So great. If most of the time, not all of the time, but enough of the time, our caregivers are sort of tuning into us, responding to us, available to us, we feel safe, right? We feel secure with them. And then if we feel safe and secure with them, we feel safe and secure to explore the environment and go beyond them, quite literally, right? And then we feel safe and secure in the world at large. So that's the basic premise, but more than half of the time, that's not what happens for folks.
Right.
You know, a lot of the time we have caregivers, parents that are not available. They might quite literally not be around, or if they're around, they're inconsistent, they're unpredictable, or, you know, they're consumed, and it's not necessarily parental blame. They might have a lot of hardships in their life, legitimate challenges, health conditions, poverty, racism that impact the ability to be available, to be responsive, you right. know, to a child. There's too many kids in the house, or there's too many generations with special needs, and, you know, or I have a health issue that is challenging. So more than half of the time, people are not able to tend to those attachment needs in the way that our nervous system really needs. And so when that happens, there's more of an insecure attachment style. Mm-hmm. And there's three types of insecure attachment styles. There's more of the withdrawn, pulled back, which is called avoidant dismissive, where, okay, I'm realizing, even if maybe people aren't physically, like literally there's neglect or abandonment and no one's here, or people are physically here, but they're just not emotionally engaged or attuned to me. Mm. So I'm realizing I'm better off relying on myself. And so someone in that scenario is going to minimize their own attachment needs and become more self-reliant, right? And so, and what happens is they're avoiding attachment bids from others or themselves, and they're really like shutting down and dismissing their own attachment needs, not because they want to, right? Because it hurts way too much to have our attachment needs active and no one's meeting them. So it becomes a strategy, a very wise strategy, to sort of shut those needs down. Yeah. The other end of the spectrum is someone who becomes more preoccupied or anxious, insecure attachment. And that's usually when caregivers are around and they're inconsistently available or they're unpredictable. So there is love where it's like, sometimes you're super tuned into me, you're playing with me, you're like really attentive and attuned, and then sometimes not at all, right? Or, you know, parent has a substance use issue, and sometimes you're great, and then sometimes I have no idea if you're gonna slap me in the face or yell at mom or dad, or, you know. So these situations where the parent is around and there's love, but it's unpredictable. And so in that case, the child is having to look outward and become preoccupied with, how are they? Is everything okay? Am I okay? I'm okay if they're okay. You know, there's a lot of this hypervigilance of tuning in externally. And then, and also sometimes learning. So what happens is the attachment system stays in hyperactive mode. And sometimes also learning like, oh, if I ask two times in a regular voice, you're ignoring me. But if I get demanding or I start to cry, then I get attention, even if it's negative attention. So you learn, oh, the louder I get, the bigger I get, the more difficult I get, or needy I get, then finally I get something. So I'm going to keep my attachment system also hyperactivated because then I finally get something, which is better than nothing. So that's the other end.
Yeah.
And then disorganized, or what's then called fearful avoidant in adulthood, is sort of a combination of the two, where someone vacillates between the withdrawing attachment or the hypervigilant anxious attachment. And that's usually in cases where there's been more severe trauma. All of these attachment styles are forms usually of trauma, whether complex, you know, relational trauma or situational traumas. But with disorganized, there's usually been more ongoing trauma and a caregiver that is scary in some way, where the person who's supposed to be comforting me is the source of my fear. And that's super confusing for the nervous system. So what happens is simultaneously, the defense systems of fight, flight, and freeze are activated. And then you want to, and then the attachment system says, well, go, when you, that happens, when there's a threat, go towards your attachment figure, but that's the person you shouldn't go towards. So there's this real back and forth feeling in the nervous system. It's very paradoxical.
Yeah. In your book, you have a part, I think it says like a caveat to attachment styles. And you make a point to say that, you know, attachment theory is not about blaming the caretakers.
That's right.
So tell me a little bit what you mean by that, because maybe to someone else, it's like, oh, the, you know, blame the parents for everything. Yeah. Like, how do you, you know, because I totally get what you mean and it's explained extremely well in your book, but like, can you tell us a little bit about what you mean when it's like, it's not about blaming the caretakers necessarily?
Right. So sort of like I just said, there's valid reasons why caregivers might not be available.
Right. Yeah.
So if a caregiver has their own attachment trauma, multi-generational trauma, someone in the house has illness, there's another sibling with special needs, the child themselves has special needs. So there's a lot of variation of how people that are on sort of, you know, autism spectrum, how they will attach and bond. Right?
Yeah.
Things like that complicate, you know, attachment. Poverty, racism, sexism, you know, there's direct studies that show that when a mother is working over 40 hours outside of the house, it compromises the attachment of the child, right? Mm. But that's like not maybe a choice that mother has, right? Really? To have to work two or three jobs just to put food on the table, right? Yeah. Parents that are incarcerated, you know, that's not always just a black and white issue in terms of you committed a crime, you should be incarcerated, right? It's very complex, right? So these societal complexities can show up in these individual abilities to attach and bond. And it's really important just to recognize that it's not just parental blaming. I think too, there's a generational thing. Like my grandmother would talk about her generation just being told, don't pick up the crying baby.
Yeah. Seriously. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that was what she was told. And so it's just, and now we can look back at that and go, oh my goodness. It's like the exact opposite.
A lot of insecurely attached people from that time.
Right. Yeah. Case in point, my mom and my aunt and my uncle.
Right. Right.
I can look at that and go, oh, right. So it's just my grandma was doing the best that she was doing what she thought was the best thing. And then it wasn't, you know, and then that
was like, there was, it can be generational because there was there like that. I remember that movement or just hearing about it from my relatives of like, oh, let the child self-soothe and cry kind of on their own and let it pass. And then now there's such an emphasis on like skin time and like initial. Exactly. So it really can be just the information is different as the world has gone on, you know?
Yeah. I also, there was a fight between my father and his mother, my grandmother, that I witnessed like maybe 15 years ago. So I was still an adult, and he just started yelling at her basically and saying, he's like, you never said I love you. Right. Hmm. And then she was like, what? I was at every swim meet. I was with you every day after school, every competition. And I was just like, oh, this is a battle of the love languages. Like,
Yeah.
here she was, acts of service and quality time, and he was words of affirmation, right? He wanted to hear, I love you. And yet to her, she was living, I love you, through being there all the time. You know, so it's just, that was really interesting to see, like, oh, wow, that can even create attachment differences, just parents and children having different love languages, probably having different Enneagram, Myers-Briggs, like you name it.
Yeah. And yeah. And you're right. I feel like that's such a common thing that I've heard and that I've experienced as well, of like, not necessarily words of affirmations, but like driving kids everywhere or being there for important events, but not necessarily emotionally maybe expressing those needs in a way that would be affirming to somebody. I definitely, yeah. And you're right. It can all create attachment wounds or just confusion at the minimum. You know?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And sometimes those things don't register as attachment, you know? So I think it's important to, like, none of these things are a given. You know, that sometimes kids have a parent that works all the time, but they feel really loved by that parent. And that parent, however they're able to do it, is able to, like, transmit that to their child, even though they're not available all the time or enough of the time.
Yeah. And you've seen people that maybe their caregivers or parents have not necessarily been there, or that maybe they've been impacted by some of the things that we just discussed, and yet the person is still able to develop a secure attachment. So it's not set in stone necessarily about how someone's going to be impacted by a parent's behavior.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's why it's not about purely blaming the parent.
Totally. So my other question is, what can each style look like in a relationship as adults? Like behaviors, maybe, that if someone is looking into their attachment style or unsure, like, what are some behaviors of each attachment style that are indicative of maybe that's something that is happening for the person?
Yeah. Great. So the withdrawn, dismissive, avoidant style still wants relationships and still attaches, right? However, people might be held at arm's length. They might usually be referred to as a lone wolf.
Mm.
And in Stan Tatkin's work, he calls this style the island, right? That they can retreat onto their own island. They can feel sometimes inaccessible. They might not be great at tuning in to their partner and their partner's emotional realities, or they usually don't know their own emotional inner landscape.
Mm.
When things get too intense, like, oh, there's too much conflict, or maybe there's too much emotional intensity, you know, in a what would maybe be seen as like intimacy, there can be a pullback, or like, okay, I'm up to this point, hit my capacity, gotta go retreat. And usually this style does more what's called auto-regulation, or like self, but it's not like self-regulation in the conscious, intentional way of like, oop, I'm struggling, I'm going to pause, I'm going to soothe myself, you know, I'm going to use my breath or use my skills. It's usually like, oh, I'm going to go and I'm going to zone out. I need to retreat to myself to sort of come back to center.
Mm.
Those are going to be some of the signs. I do see like, it's almost more of a feminine version of this, where someone's like a caretaker for everyone in their life, but they're actually more of this avoidant, dismissive style. Cause they're like in the process of taking care of everyone else, they're actually completely denying themselves. So
wow, that's like, interesting.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah.
And in that caretaking, they might not necessarily actually be attuned to what others really need, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's one version. Then the preoccupied anxious is just that, like, there's going to be a lot more anxiety, more feelings, you know, more emotions that happen, quicker to bond, quicker to attach. People have, and each of these styles has strengths, you know, the strength in the anxious preoccupied is very tuned in to the other, really can track what's going on with them. But sometimes they're taking it too personally. So your partner's just cranky because they're hungry or had a bad day at work. And they're like, oh, are you angry at me? Is something wrong? Are we okay? So they're really good at like tuning into the subtleties and the nuance of someone's shifts, but their interpretation might not actually be very accurate. And so there's a lot of focus outward on tuning into the other and, you know, is the other there for me? Do they love me? Am I enough? And often when they actually get what they want, so they usually feel a lot of imbalance, like, oh, I'm giving more than I'm receiving, or I'm not getting exactly what I need. But then when it comes towards them, they usually don't know how to receive it. Mm. And all of these styles are going to struggle with receiving, of course, because that's sort of where this came from, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, this is going to be maybe a more intense or high voltage partner. Texting a lot, wants a lot of connection, really does well with connection, doesn't do well with being alone or saying goodbye or, you know, periods of separation from their partner. Whereas the avoidant dismissive, right, they really like that solo time that they have, and they're going to struggle a little bit more. It's going to take longer to warm up into the connection.
I really like in your book how you talk about each of the attachment styles as adaptive strategies, because I think in a lot of the literature, I feel that sometimes the avoidant person or the avoidant dismissive is like framed as like the better kind of route than the anxious person, and how they're like less needy, quote unquote, and like how that's kind of a better thing or something. And I really liked how in your book you talk about each of the attachment styles as like a strengths-based, how basically everyone's just trying to get their needs met, and how all of these strategies are really like adaptive styles in getting these needs, or at least attempting to get these needs met. Because I do feel that sometimes in the current literature, it can be, or at least in like dialogue, it can really be like, it's all about like being less needy, as opposed to addressing the person who's maybe avoiding those needs, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, I think, I mean, in their extremes and the way they get pathologized is unfortunately the withdrawn, avoidant, dismissive can go, like people call it more narcissism. Mm. And, you know, in the anxious, preoccupied, it's like borderline personality disorder, you know? And yet those are not what these people are, you know? And yeah, I think there's a huge cultural piece that you're pointing to, that as a culture, we value independence.
Yeah.
And we still are suppressing the feminine, which holds the emotional realm, you know, and there's still this, the patriarchal, colonialistic, you know, dominance still exists that says, you know, the feminine realm of needs and emotions and connection is lesser than. So I see how that shows up absolutely in dialogue, that like as if the avoidant dismissive is preferable because it's more independent.
Yes.
But it's not. Yeah. But it's not actually independent, you know?
No.
Right. The secure attachment is somebody who can go back and forth between, I can be by myself, I'm actually autonomous, and I can make healthy decisions and have boundaries for myself. And then I can go into connection and really like bond and love and show up and have my needs and meet your needs. Like that's where the healthy independence is actually showing up, in the giving and receiving of needs through the secure attachment.
Yeah. And I think there's also been this demonization of like codependency also. Mm-hmm. And it's an inherent part of, I mean, I work from the framework of like, it's an inherent part of being alive and in community, is that you have to be dependent on others, and that dependence is healthy, not necessarily problematic. And like, yes, of course, there are aspects of dependence that can be harmful to ourselves, but it's not inherently an issue.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's the essence, the roots of attachment theory, is saying, it's like, hello, we are absolutely dependent as children on our caregivers around us.
Yeah.
ends that that's where this is stemming from. But yeah, as adults, that it grows more into an interdependence. Yeah, because yeah, codependence or dependence or neediness, these are like, you know, bad words, right, is what's happened, unfortunately.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I also like, I want to talk about for a second, the moving, how now, and some researchers and in your book, you spend some time on this about how the research is moving away from the four type model and discussing more how attachment can kind of move on a spectrum between attachment anxiety and attachment avoidance, if I said that correctly. Can you explain a little bit about that and why you found that more useful in your work rather than like the four type?
Yeah, I mean, the four types fit into that, you know, whether you are high or low on attachment avoidance, or high or low, combining with or intersecting with high or low on attachment anxiety. But for one, you know, like anything, when we encounter it, we want to identify with it. And sometimes that is needed first to really identify with something. But then it can go too far, and there can be this, like, you know, especially towards others in your life, like, well, you're just an anxiously attached person, as if that's all of who someone is. It becomes totalizing, you know, where people identify with their own style as if it's an excuse, you know, for their for their behaviors that are causing harm to themselves or others, you know, and as if it's a free pass, you know, for those behaviors, right? Or as if it's static. So that's another caveat that I give in the book, is that these are not static. So even people listening now might be like, oh, wow, I'm all of those, right?
Yeah.
Or, and what we really see in non-monogamous partnerships is, with multiple partners, you can be expressing different attachment styles with each of them, right? Which is fascinating and sometimes really confusing, right? So, excuse me. So yeah, just making sure we're not over-identifying. And then what I like about seeing things on a spectrum is just holding that movability, right? That, yeah, sometimes I'm higher or lower on my attachment anxiety and higher or lower on my attachment avoidance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In your work, is it, are there times when like one partner, maybe the one that leans more avoidant or perhaps more secure, and another person leans more anxious, are there times when like their needs are too much?
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Like, are there times when it's like, no, you actually are asking too much of this person, and that these are unrealistic kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. There are times when it's like, I'm thinking of a partnership that I've been working with, and her complaint has been all the things that he hasn't done. And as he's increased doing those things, the goalpost keeps moving, you know?
Yeah.
And like those things now aren't enough, and then there's more things, and, you know, and it keeps happening. And so at some point it was like, okay, you're not actually like taking in his efforts, you know, you're not receiving what he's doing. Every time he does it, there's a criticism of it. So we've had to work with that. So yeah, there is. And sometimes too, in non-monogamous relationships, really any monogamous, non-monogamous, the whole spectrum, but there can be like certain demands of trying to like limit what your partner can do, or limit what their other partner can do with you. And it can be like, yeah, that's really not fair. That's impacting the autonomy of these other people.
Yeah, absolutely. Right?
Yeah. Or like, yeah, if your partner's at work, you can't expect them, or your partner's out with someone else, you can't expect to be just like open bar available to you all day. Like, that's just not realistic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the work with the partner would also be kind of looking at those needs and how to either meet them themselves a little bit, and or like regulate them a little bit more, so that they don't feel necessarily abandoned by the partner who is trying their best, but that some of these needs just aren't realistic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's multiple ways. I mean, individually, whether it's working with them a little individually or they have another therapist, you know, I'm just like, yeah, you didn't get enough of what you needed. That is absolutely true in your past. And how to not be just constantly projecting that onto this relationship, you know, and how to do the work of receiving, how to do the work of inner soothing and not always looking to co-regulate. You know, in that case, it's not co-regulate, it's other regulation. Yeah. So that would be some of the ways to work with it.
Yeah. So I want to switch a little bit to trauma. As you said in your book, it is difficult to talk about attachment without talking about trauma. So, and some of the, you know, I think your book, at least in the literature that I've read, was so impactful because I had one client who told me, which I thought was amazing, you know, she said she read The Ethical Slut and she was saying how like, it read to her how it would be like, if non-monogamy went absolutely perfect, no, and it didn't really account for experiences of trauma or someone who has a lot of trauma. And I really thought that was spot on, you know? And so your book kind of builds on that and does incorporate trauma into attachment and to consensual non-monogamy and how it just acknowledges it in a way that I think is cohesive for one of the first times. And so for this discussion, how do we define trauma?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a big word.
Yes.
And there's like capital T trauma, lowercase trauma, you know, some of this is used too much. But you know, I like the usage of trauma as it is on a spectrum of stress, right? And that on one end we sort of have stress and then it keeps going to the other end of trauma. And trauma are the events, whether it's a single event or it is accumulation of events that build up in the nervous system or blast our nervous system in a single event, and our body and psyche cannot process that. There's too much, right? And like even quite literally, the like chemical blast of all of the stress hormones like cannot be processed through the liver, you know, and like through the body, like the physiology is too intense, you know, or the impact on the heart and the mind is too much. And we sort of cross a threshold into when it's like, oh, I'm not able to function, or I'm not able to like integrate and process this anymore. I can't catch up. I'm sinking is what it feels like. Right. And what I like about that idea is that it takes away, because there's ways of labeling like certain events as if they are inherently traumatic. And there are certain events I think are, but you know, it's so interesting that not everyone has certain experiences, that some people go through an event and they're traumatized and other people go through the same event and they're not, right?
Yeah.
So it is all the amount of, you know, how your body and mind and heart can process or not, how much overwhelm there is.
I want to talk a little bit about the nested model of attachment and trauma. Did you build this model?
I did. Yes. Oh,
okay. So tell me about it. Exactly what it is, you know, and like how, again, like how it's just tell me about it.
it was inspired by Dugan's model, like a nested model of conflict. But it, like, as seeing in that, I then was inspired to make the nested model of trauma and attachment. And so in the center of the nest, we go from self, and then like one rung out is relationship, then home, then community, like local community and culture, then society, and then sort of collective global, right? And so the point is showing that each of these are not actually separate. They're all interconnected, and yet they are distinct, right? But in their distinctions, there is sort of a relationship of up and down with all of these. And so that trauma can happen at any one of these levels. Attachment ruptures can happen at any one of these levels. And then it can go up or down, right? So some people, they didn't have attachment wounds in their household, but they got to school and they didn't fit in. And that's where their attachment wound happened, right? Or like we were just bringing up earlier, you know, societal issues of something like racism or poverty, right? That those are societal issues, but those trickle down, you know, into what your community looks like and what your home looks like, into the relationships you have, into the self and the identity. So just wanting to show that these go up and down. And sometimes, especially with attachment, you know, we tend to focus on it's the levels of self, which would be your attachment styles and your history, and then the level of relationship, one rung out, you know, what happened, right, in your history with your caregivers or your early childhood relationships, and then what's happening in your adult relationships. So I wanted to expand it, for one, to say it's not just limited to those two places. And if we only look in those two levels, we can miss a lot of other places that attachments, ruptures, and trauma are happening, as well as all of these levels offer healing, you know, and we can miss resources in these different levels that can really impact the healing of trauma, the repair of attachment ruptures, you know, that again, go up and down through the levels.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I love that, because I think it's sometimes, I'll speak for myself, I often find myself dismissing sometimes like global trauma, yeah, or, you know, the outer layers of the trauma. Yeah. 'Cause I'm like, oh, that doesn't necessarily affect my day-to-day life. Right. And I think it's a way to cope with it a bit.
Yeah.
And kind of dismiss it, you know, a bit of like, oh no, but that's not really impacting my relationship. And sure, maybe one incident is not necessarily, but collectively they do add up a bit and impact the way I move through the world and the way I perceive the world, perceive myself, perceive my relationships, perceive people, you know? So I really liked how, I also like the idea of like moving through each layer as a way to repair and to like heal attachment, and using them for resources, which is absolutely, you know, something that I believe in as well. Like you can meet your attachment needs in so many ways.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Certain levels might not be as immediately available to you, but then you can look to certain other levels and there might be, yeah, supports that are there. And then we probably don't have time to go through it now, but the point in the book that I make is that when people open up from monogamy to non-monogamy, whoa, there's all these attachment ruptures at those different levels that a lot of people just didn't anticipate, you know, or societally, culturally, we don't necessarily acknowledge, you know, and yet also a lot of people experience like, oh, there's more support and love at some of these levels. Like, wow, I didn't know, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And on that, you know, like, how do we heal our attachment wounds or trauma while we are in relationships or dating, or just being in the world, which really does lead to additional attachment wounds? Like, are they both possible? Because I know sometimes it's like someone feels like they're healing or they're making progress, and then they date somebody who, you know, reopens the wound, and then it feels like they're back to where they were. And like, how can we, like, how do we do it?
Yeah. Good question. Yeah. And that was the point of the third part of my book, is like, here's some suggestions on what you can do. And so I came up with the acronym HEARTS.
Yes. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So HEARTS. And so the, it's doing it within partnership and then also doing it with yourself, right? So seeing that, 'cause there can be, you know, different dialogues, cultures, memes, right? Might have like, oh, you should only do your inner work and you shouldn't even be in relationship until you do it. Or, you know, you only heal in relationship and people don't realize they also need to do their inner work. So I'm saying we need to do both. And some of that is simultaneous. Some of that goes back and forth, right? Some things can't become available to us in terms of relationship until we do certain aspects of inner work. And some things can't become available until we feel a certain kind of acceptance or love in a relationship, you know? So just honoring the importance and significance of both of those. So yeah, hearts, H is for here, for being present, the importance of being present with our partners, being present with ourselves, and really defining together or with yourself, like, what does that mean? You know, what does it mean to be fully present, not distracted when I'm with a partner? What does that mean to have presence with myself and my relationship to me? Then E is express delight, which is this quality. It's not just words of affirmation. It's sort of the quality of, I like take delight in your beingness. I love this one. Right? Of like, you know, and it's sort of, you look across the room and you see your partner and they just give you the eyes, right? And you know that you're adored in a certain way, or that you're valued, and not for what you do, but just for fundamentally who you are. Mm. Right. And that can go a long way in relationship of just working on that sense of feeling that expressed delight. And how do we register expressed delight? How do we know it in our relationships? And then, you know, with self expressed delight, the biggest obstacle is in the inner critic and shame. Mm-hmm. And so often we need to go into inner critic and shame work so that we can start to just have gratitude for ourselves, you know, to delight, right? To appreciate just being alive and who we are as a person, or what we do in the world, how we contribute, those kind of things. Then H-E-A, A is attunement. So this is the quality of tuning in, right? To the other, tuning into self, right? And in relationship, it doesn't mean I have to agree with you, right? But I can tune into and want to step into your shoes, or really understand your perspective, even if it's different than mine. Or the subtleties of just picking up, like, oh, you just said you had a hard day. Like, let me register that, you know? Mm-hmm. And like, how can I tune into you and support you, right? Or maybe asking you to like go out and do this thing isn't the right thing, you know? Tuning into self is just even the basic foundational capacities of, what am I needing? What am I feeling? You know, on all levels, like very bodily basic needs, like around food, rest, sleep, you know, nourishment, sex, all of that. Yeah. But then tuning into also the more emotional, psychological, spiritual needs and feelings that are there.
Yeah.
Then H-E-A-R is, it's rituals and routines, right? Mm-hmm. That in relationships. So attachment can really be forged through having rituals and routines, and children and infants do well when there's this sense of ritual and routine and regularity. So in the book, I talk about sort of the everyday mundane, like, what are your hello and goodbye rituals? What are your good night and good morning rituals? Even if you don't live with each other, right? Or maybe I see you once a month, but we sort of have the things that are special to us and the ways that we like approach and part from each other that have meaning to us. Right. And then what are the bigger rituals, like ceremonies, rites of passage, you know, acknowledgments of relationships sort of becoming more, or even, you know, transitioning to something that's less romantic. So that's really important. And then the T is turning towards after conflict.
Mm. So
the research is really clear. Even partners in secure relationships, secure attachment, they still fight. Yeah. It's not just, you know, there's still arguments, there's still misunderstandings, there's still disagreements. But what securely attached partners do is they repair really quickly. And it's not even that they have the best repair skills, it's just very genuine. Like, I want to fix this with you. I want to repair this with you. I want to take responsibility for my part in it. And let's learn from this so it doesn't keep happening. You know, that's the essence of it. And yeah. Then with Yeah. And then with self, it's, you know, when I fall short of my own standards or my hopes, I make a mess up. Do I just default to that inner critic and beat myself up? Right. How do I repair with myself when there's been a rupture? So, and then the S in hearts is secure attachment with self. And I sort of already, I simultaneously went through both ends of that.
Yeah. No, I love that. And that's kind of that is your suggestion for how people can move through the world while healing their attachment and work on their relationships to form secure attachments.
Yeah, exactly. And getting support is obviously great, whether that's through a book or a course or a therapist or a coach or, you know, a healer. Like, it, you know, I'm not attached to what that looks like, but usually we need support. And then also just knowing that it might ebb and flow. Like, even in my own life, I've had certain attachment healings that I did need to take, like, okay, I need a few months off from relationships, you know, like, and I need to do certain kinds of inner work for a few months before I'm ready again to, like, enter into relationship from more of a secure place. And then there's been times where it's like only certain levels of healing were available because of that relationship itself.
Yeah. We didn't even really get to non-monogamy, but it's okay. So I guess my final, you know, question for you is, like, throughout the years of working, you know, in attachment with individuals, in with couples, with trauma, like, words of wisdom, your final words of wisdom, in terms of, like, what you've learned and how people who maybe feel that they struggle with attachment, and trauma, like, what would be your words of wisdom?
Yeah. I mean, in general, right, is just knowing, like, it is totally healable. It might not seem that way. It might take a year or two, right?
Yeah.
And to know that this is sort of more of a marathon than a sprint. I say that even with non-monogamy in general, like, the transition, like, this isn't a sprint. You're not going to get to this transition in 3 months. Like, you got to give it a year or two. But for attachment, it's like, yes, this is absolutely healable. And with that, non-monogamy and attachment, yeah, there's so much obviously we can say of, you know, how many ruptures can happen, also how much healing can happen. But if you're in a non-monogamous situation and you're having what I identify as primal panic, you know, in the book, or you're having attachment ruptures, like, slow down. Please slow down. and like, you know, really honoring, especially if you're the person that has a partner that's struggling with attachment ruptures, with primal attachment panic, like, it will get better, but it does need to be, like, acknowledged and addressed. You know, it's not something that can be sped through.
I love the slow down and the be gentle.
Yeah. Slow down and be gentle. And that's hard because usually there's a partner that wants to just speed ahead because it's so exciting to be non-monogamous, right? Yeah. And yet it, like, that actually can slow down the process because you could have a partner who's just, the pacing was too fast and they're traumatized by that. Then you can't do it for a while, right? Or the relationship can't hold it. And what I see is when partners initially go slower, they paradoxically move faster in the long run.
Totally. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Jessica. This was really, really amazing. I really, really appreciate it.
As always, thank you so much for listening. This was an interview with Jessica Fern, psychotherapist, coach, and author of Polysecure. You can find Jessica Fern and learn more at www.jessicafern.com. You can find me, Sarah Kelleher, at PsychandTheCityBK on Instagram. You can email me at PsychandTheCityBK@gmail.com. If you have a topic you'd like me to cover on the podcast, just want to chat, or really anything, it's really, really helpful to rate and review the podcast if you're enjoying it. So I hope you do that. Thanks.